All right. Well, we're coming at it. This is being recorded? Yeah. Fuck. I always wanted to do that. pardon me? Yes. Yes. I don't like doing this. I was okay. I knew about this for about 2 weeks, and I was okay till this morning, and I woke up, and my wife, Jerry, says, well, how are you doing this morning? And I said, I'm really nervous. And as the time went on during the day, it seemed to progress, kind of like this disease does. And when I got here, it was like my stomach was going, and I'm really glad there's not like a lot of people here tonight. Anyway, you guys ready for some recovery? Then buy a book, go to meetings, get a sponsor. all those things they told me to do when I got here. Grateful to be clean. I want to, what do I want to do? I want to wish everybody a happy holiday season. You know, and I'm not going to dwell on the holidays, I don't think, too much because, just because, I don't know why. I just, you know, this time of the year, you hear a lot about holidays and how tough it is, I guess it is for some people. And, you know, for me, I got clean, November 16th is my clean date, so I got clean right before Thanksgiving and went through, the holidays, and it wasn't that tough. I mean, not because it was the holidays. What was tough was just I wanted to get loaded all the time. Okay, that was the only thing. Days are days, you know, and I guess some days celebrate a little bit differently than others. That's kind of how I look at it. I hope I don't get into a long drug-a-log, but I was taught in open meetings that we share a little bit of what it was like, and I want to do that so some of the newcomers can hopefully relate and hopefully they'll understand that they're no different than anybody else in this room. When I first got here, I thought I was really different. Nobody understood the things that I went through. Nobody understood how I felt. Okay, nobody understood how I thought. The longer I stayed around here, the more I realized that just wasn't true. You know, that I wasn't any different than anybody else, than any other addict that walks into these rooms. I was scared to death. You know, I just didn't want to tell anybody. I came from... I'm having a hard time keeping my thoughts together. What I was taught was that it was the old men don't get scared, or if they do, they don't tell nobody. They're tough. They don't cry. They don't share feelings. My dad, we had a talk about the birds and the bees one time. You know what? And it was all about, are you riding them bareback? And I said, well, no, Dad. You know, and he says, okay. And that was the extent of it. That was the communications skills that I had. That was the limit, man. We just didn't talk about stuff. We didn't talk about feelings. And if we were afraid, we damn sure didn't tell anybody. And, you know, and I carried that stuff and still do into my life and into recovery. When I first got clean, I'm not like this social giant, okay? I don't do conversations well. The toughest times for me were the times before the meetings and times after the meeting. You know what? When we were standing around smoking or drinking coffee and shooting shit, I always felt out of place, you know? And I would stand there and everybody was having these conversations and I just kind of do the N.A. dodo bird, and because I didn't know how to do that. And I still struggle with that, you know. But I was such an angry person. The day I realized partially how angry I was when I got here. I sat like this in the back of rooms, the meetings, you know, and I frowned a lot. And that's how I got these wrinkles. I'm 29. And it's all a defense, you know. And I got a couple of tattoos, you know, and they're supposed to be penitentiary tattoos. I really got them in a halfway house in Porterville, my first stop in this county. But I like to people to think I got them in a penitentiary. I don't lie as much as I used to. Okay, I still lie, but just not as much. And I smoke Camel non-filters, you know, because tough guys do. And I walked the walk, and I knew how to talk the talk. And that's what I did in recovery. You know, I did it all the time. You know, my fear was that you people would get close to me. One of my fears was that you would get to know me, you know. One of my fears was that I would get to like you, you know, that I would even come to love you. You know, my experiences with those were very painful in the past. Okay, so I didn't want people to get close to me. I was afraid of that. It's like it was that double-edged sword. It's like I wanted them to. I wanted it bad. You know, but I was afraid to let you because of the pain I was afraid of experiencing. Okay, I didn't want to repeat that anymore. So I sit in the meetings like this, you know, and just kind of, you know, beat you up with my eyes and my body language, and you know, people would stay away, you know, and that's really what I wanted, you know. And there was a man, or a couple of them, really, that used to laugh at me, because they knew. I hate them old-timers, you know, they knew this shit, you know, and they'd look over at you and they'd go, they'd talk and they'd go, you know, and there's another one of them, you know, and I go, fuckers, what are they laughing at, you know, and then, when I shared, it was a lot of superficial stuff, you know, I didn't know how to feel, no, that's wrong, I think I was incapable of feeling, okay, and I was incapable of identifying feelings. I didn't know what to call them, you know, I didn't know what they were, I didn't know how to explain them, I didn't know what caused them, I didn't know how to talk about them. So when I shared, there was a lot of glamorizing, you know, glorifying, you know, the drug-a-logs that we hear sometimes. You know, I did my share of that. I used to talk about all the, you know, burglaries or our robberies, or, you know, I had the bag was this big and I had I had an ounce of heroin, and she picked me up in a Cadillac at the gate, and, you know, I mean, I got into all that kind of stuff, and then we had it going on, but it was real hard to talk about things like breaking my boy's piggy bank, stealing food stamps out of my ex-wife's purse to get a fix. Breaking into my mom and dad's house, stealing their VCR. You know, that was the things that I, you know, had a hard time sharing. But it was easy to talk a lot of shit, you know, for me. It wasn't painful. It didn't hurt, you know. I didn't have to feel. You know, and that's kind of how I did it in the early days when I shared. I was raised in Bakersfield, Oildale to be exact. Good old Oildale. Yeah, you got to use an Oildale if you're a real dope fiend. Along with Farmersville. They're kind of the same kind of towns. You know, I'm not real sure why I used. I think when I was in high school, I got real curious about what other people were doing. I had a real hard time making friends and keeping friends. I didn't have very many close friends. you know, I kept to myself. There was a group of people that at school who, you know, they had some long hair and they had holes in their Levi's and they just looked like, you know, they didn't give a shit. And that's kind of how I felt. And I wanted to be a part of that. That just was attractive to me. And those people were, you know, they called them hippies in those days. And those people were smoking dope, drinking beer, eating acid, and all that kind of stuff, you know. You know, I got offered some one day, and I remember, you know, I smoked. This one dude, he was like the man, you know. He had the bag, and everybody was his friend, and you know, everybody wanted to hang out with him because he had the bag, you know. So I went up to him one day and I said, "Hey, man, you know, I want to get high." And he says, "You do, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to get high, man." And he says, "All right." So he gave me this big old fat joint. And I was 15 years old, never smoked a joint in my life, just barely started smoking cigarettes, and it was kind of lame to all this stuff, so, you know, he told me how to do it, and I said, all right, you know, so I went home, and I went in the bathroom, you know, and I locked the door, and I turned on the fan, like, nobody's going to smell this shit, right, sat there on the toilet, smoked this joint and did it, just followed the instructions. Probably the only time in my life I've ever followed directions, smoked that whole damn joint and didn't get loaded. And I thought this dude was messing with me. I thought he was messing with me. So I went back, I was pissed the next day, and I said, you know, what's the deal here, man? Are you messing with me or, you know, what? And he started laughing at me. Then I really got mad because I was embarrassed. I thought I got took it, you know. He gave me another one. He said, "Nah, it's just that happens sometimes, you know." So he gave me another one, and I went home. Oh, by the way, Mom said, "What's that smell in the house?" You know, and my mom, she would believe anything. I made up some bullshit story, and she bought it. I think mostly out of fear of the truth. You know, that's kind of how it went. You know, and when I started getting high, man, I loved it. You know what? We hear that a lot around here, but I really did love it. I had a lot of fun. You know what? Or I don't think I'd have continued. You know? I believe that today. I had a lot of good times. You know what? Partying in high school, drinking, smoking weed, just, you know, doing all that stuff we do, and we did. At some point, I don't know when it was, how old I was, or what happened, I just crossed this imaginary line, I believe, into addiction. You know, school was no longer important. Jobs were not important. Family was not important. There wasn't anything more important than getting loaded for me. And I started cutting school. I went to every high school in Bakersfield that they had at that time. Because I would go and I would get kicked out for this and that and usually not going. Because I spent all my time at the park. We called ourselves the Beale Park Bums and we were proud of it, you know. It's like, yeah, we're bums and we're proud, you know. And we would lay in the grass, drink ripple wine, smoke weed, and, you know, that was our day, you know. And there was about 30 or 40 of us that just, you know, used to do that. And then, you know, I started experimenting with other drugs. You know, one of my real tight partners in those days walked up to me and he says, come here, man. And I said, what? And I knew it was going to be good. Standing in a circle and this joint goes around and it tastes like mint and it's got this aftertaste, you know. And what it was, we called it angel dust, you know. I took a couple tokes and it was like, wow, you know, and this is great. And that's how I got introduced to a lot of drugs. My drug of choice was heroin. That doesn't make me any better, any different than anybody else in this room. That's just what I used. That's what I preferred. I'd use any damn thing. The first time I slammed dope, I did a cotton. You know, there was four guys, and they split a nickel paper. We were sitting in the kitchen at one of them's grandma's house. And they asked me, we were pretty good friends, and they said, "You want to go?" I said, "Yeah, where are you guys going?" "Well, we're going to go shoot this dope." And I said, "Well, sure, I got to go." And never done it before in my life. Terrified. And we're sitting at the kitchen table, and I'm just watching them because it ain't my dope. Just kind of seeing the whole process, you know, pulling it, the spoon, kicking it up, drawing it up. And they started pounding the cottons, and they drew it all up and said, "Here, you want this?" And inside I went, "Oh, no." You know, excuse me, but I said, "Well, sure," you know. And, you know, and I got loaded for the first time on heroin. I loved it, you know. I discovered what I call tragic magic. You know, it was, it created a magic, at least it felt like it created a magic within and just was a cure-all, but there was a lot of years of tragedy, you know, around that. You know, people talk about losing things and all that. I kind of look at it as I just give them away for the privilege of getting loaded. You know, that's what it was about. You know, marriages and homes and things like that, you know. I got introduced to Narcotics Anonymous in June or July of 1982. I was married to my first wife at the time and had a couple of kids and I was doing pretty good. I was just drinking a lot of alcohol, smoking some weed, and I hadn't fixed in a number of years. And I was in my, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and matter of fact, I was 30 years old. And my folks said he had a welding business and he had sold it and bought a liquor store out in Lamont. Anybody know where Lamont is? Yeah, another good town to drink in, use in, whatever you want to do. And so they had this liquor store, and my dad says, "Hey, you want to come work for me?" And I said, "Sure, Dad." And, you know, they offered me a key to the liquor store, and I'm out of there. And, you know, that's what I did for a while. I worked there for 7 years, became physically addicted to alcohol, became bloated and, you know, very sick. When I didn't drink, I got sick. I used to keep a case of booze in the closet and a case of half pints in the trunk and, you know, carry them in my boots. I mean, that's what I did. Every waking minute, man, was drink alcohol, you know, smoke weed. And I thought I was doing good, man, because I wasn't slamming dope. I kind of skipped that part about the treatment center. I want to go back to that because that was real valuable for me. It was one of those six-week programs in Bakersfield with, you know, two man rooms, and they cooked your food for you, and, you know, they treated you pretty nice. That's when I still had insurance. And they told me that we're an alcohol program, and we don't know if we can help you. See, I started slamming dope again, you know, when I worked at that liquor store. One of my old partners walked through the door one night and said, "Hey, Holmes, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, good to see you." He says, "I got a bag. What time you get off?" And I said, "Well, you know, we can leave right now, you know." And I just closed the damn store and went. And we got loaded, and we were off and running, you know. And then I got into, like, ripping off the till and selling kegs and cartons of cigarettes and any goddamn thing, you know, gas. I mean, it didn't matter, you know, whatever it took. And finally one day, the guilt of ripping off my parents was beginning to become so intense that I couldn't do it anymore. You know, I walked in and I started crying and I looked at him and I just threw him the keys and I said, "You know, I've been stealing from you for a good year or so and I can't do it anymore. I gotta go." And I left. And that was a real difficult time, and that was something I had to bring into recovery and take care of and make amends for. You know, thank God that recovery offers us a process to do that. You know, and I'm on real good relationships with my parents today. There was a time I wasn't allowed in the house. You know, if they saw me coming, they would call the cops, literally. You know, and they don't do that. They let me spend the night in their house, you know, borrow their car if I need it, you know, that kind of shit. You know, they've even loaned me money since I've been in recovery. So a lot of things have changed. You know, there's that trust back. So anyway, you know what, this treatment center taught me a lot. I remember my very first meeting was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, not Narcotics Anonymous. There wasn't a lot of Narcotics Anonymous back then. And this treatment center, you had to go. You didn't have a choice, and you left the program, and they took us all down in this van. It was in Oildale, California, and it was in this little room and had egg cartons on the ceiling, and they were all nicotine stained. I thought they had painted them gold, and I sat down, and the chairperson was sitting up here at a table like this, and there was tables all around, and it's a real small room, and there was a lot of people in there. I mean, it was packed, and it was so smoky you couldn't hardly see, and everybody was laughing and joking, and then the meeting started, and this guy said, "I'm Don, I'm an alcoholic." Everybody said, "Hi, Don," and I went, "What the fuck is going on here?" And that freaked me out. You know, but I just kind of sat there in my pose and, you know, did the thing. And I'm grateful for that today. You know, I didn't understand what was going on. I mean, I had no clue. You know, I didn't know how people were staying clean and sober. You know, how was this going to work? I had no idea, no concept. There was another dope fiend in there with me in this program. And we went, like, because we got, we know things, and we got some demands here, and we want to go to Narcotics Anonymous because we're not alcoholics, and by God, we're paying good money, so, and they let us go, you know. And when I went to my first NA meeting that summer in 1982, and walked into the meeting, and it was a real small meeting. There was like six or seven people there, and most of them were loaded. You know, I mean, Tony and I, this guy that we went together, we were like freaking out. It was scary, you know, because we looked around and people were scratching, and, you know, and that was my experience with my first NA meeting. There wasn't a lot of recovery in them days, at least at that meeting. They're doing well down there today, I hear, but, anyway, I didn't stay clean. You know, I stayed in that program for 6 weeks. Now, I'm real good at like compliance. I've always been pretty good at compliance. You know, following directions, doing as I'm told, you know, just because I don't want to make any waves. You know, I don't want to be noticed. I never like to be noticed, man. You know, that was like one of the codes on the streets. You don't do anything to be noticed, right? You know, keep a low profile, don't be noticed. You know, and, you know, so I was real good at that stuff, man. It came easy. It was a piece of cake, you know. I've been locked up several times and never got no shit, you know. I mean, I've never been, the man's never hassled me. I just do my time and leave, you know. And that's the kind of guy I am. I don't have to have, I don't want all that attention. And his attention also used to get people in trouble. That was my experiences. So I did that, and I got out, and I went back to my first ex-wife, and I was staying clean. I was out for 2 weeks, and I was staying clean, and then this thought occurred to me. Heroin was your problem. You could probably smoke weed, you know. This little voice back here, and I thought, yeah, shit, Rick, that's a good idea. You know, you probably can. So that's what I did. You know, I went over to a partner's house I used to run around with and smoked a couple joints with him that night. And I remember the shame and the guilt I felt, even then, even before I was way ready to recover. You know, the feelings of being a failure, you know, of not being able to do anything right, you know, of being deceitful, dishonest, you know. 3 days later, I was fixing again, you know. I was fixing again. I had a job, you know, I quit the liquor store and I had a job. I used to drive a truck for Pepsi Cola, and I'd around Kern County, and I would always like the cash stops. Okay, because I had figured out a way to rip them off. And what I don't know if I'm going to tell you how I used to do it, but I hit my first stop, and the guy would pay me in cash, and I'd drive my Pepsi truck in my little Pepsi uniform to the connection man, and I'd park it outside, and I'd go inside, I'd fix, and, you know, and there it goes. And one day I'm going to kick. I've had enough. My wife's going to leave me, and I'm going to kick. So I figured out this plan. I'll steal all the money, buy a bunch of dope and pills, don't forget the pills, so you can kick, and go out of town and kick. So that's what I did. I stole $1,500 of cash I had this day. Thursday was my big cash day, and I just had this plan for a week, man. And I was serious. I was going to kick. So I stole all the money. I parked the truck, jumped in my car, took the money with me, went home, shit, showered, shaved, packed a few things, went to the connection, bought a few $100 worth of dope and some pills, and off to up north I went. I didn't know where I was going. And I needed somebody to come with me. I mean, shit, you can't kick alone. And that's what we did. So we went up there and we slammed all the dope in about 2 days and ate all the pills in 2 days, and I still had about $200 or $300 left, and the brakes were grinding anyway, so I came back, you know. I remember it was so damn foggy, I ended up staying in some motel out on the freeway off of I-5, and we came on in the morning, and I went and bought, a bunch more dope. I had about $300 left. I spent all on dope. And I was really loaded, and I was going to go see my kids because, by God, they needed to see their dad, right? And the insanity we come up with, man, the insanity, I was so gout I could hardly stand up. I had nodded out in front of some lady's driveway with my car running, and she woke me up tapping on the window, and that's how loaded I was, and I thought, I'm going to see my kids. So I did, I was separated from my, she left me and then threw me out of my own house, and then I went back to visit. That's kind of how it went. So she was being nice, and she knew, obviously, that I was pretty loaded, and I was sitting there talking to my kids, and she fixed me a plate of chili dogs because obviously I needed to eat, and I fell out face down in the chili dogs, cheese and shit all over, and she got scared. She didn't know what to do. She's not a dope fiend. She didn't know how to handle dope fiends. A lot of us know how to do that. Somebody goes out, we know how to bring them back. She didn't know how, so she called the paramedics. And she didn't know that, so you know this shit, right? The paramedics come, so the cops. So by the time they get there, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm up and I've washed my face and, wiped some of the shit off me. I walk outside and the paramedics are there. I see these lights, man. So I walk outside and the paramedics are there and they're talking to me and they're starting to leave. And this cop goes, come here just a minute, I need to talk to you. They arrested me for under the influence. I start, of course, throwing a bitch and talking about my rights and telling them I need to be in that vehicle, not this one. They didn't care. So I went to jail and did a little time out of road camp and that old tire stuff. And I remember, I got out and I think I did 55 days on a 90-day sentence. I got out and I got served with divorce papers while I was in road camp for my first wife. And that was an experience. If that's never happened to you, that's an experience. And I went to divorce court in shackles. And that was an experience, a humiliating experience. I'll never forget that. But that was part of my addiction, and I went with it. So I had a little money when I got out, and I remember, man, I went to my partner's house, and he lived in Oildale, and I went straight there. I called him up at 5 in the morning and said, hey, I got this money and I'm coming. I just got out. And he says, okay, come on. I got a bag for you. You know, so we went and we got loaded. And later on that day, I scored some heroin. We were blending it up on the table. And evidently, his pad was really hot because about 7 narcs just kind of raided the place about 1 o'clock that afternoon. And I was back in jail. You know, and I was really pissed off because I lost all that heroin. And I didn't get laid. I didn't get a good meal. I was out about 30 hours, or not even that. And there I was, you know, and I got busted with 17 grams of heroin. And the judge didn't like that. We tried to tell him it was poor quality, but he didn't care. You know, who cares? So off I went and did a little time in the penitentiary. And when I got out of there, you know, and I used to tell it different than I do now. I used to talk about, you know, how cool I was in there. And I went to some meetings in there. You know, we all know, a lot of us know about H&I. And I went to some meetings in there. And one of the institutions I was in, they had meetings 6 days a week. You know, and I went to a lot of them. And it was hard in there going to those meetings, man, because I always got caught with, my look good got in the way. You know, because I always felt like I had to walk a certain way and talk a certain way on the yard, you know. Because, you know, you had to be cruel in there and you couldn't show weakness, okay, because you'd be taken advantage of, okay. You know, I always talk about, you know what, there's not a man in there that didn't shed a tear on his pillow at night at some point during that time. I know, because I did. You know, it was a real lonely time in my life, you know. A real helpless feeling, you know. I felt really out of control. But I went to some meetings in there, and I thought I was serious about recovery, and I got out, and they gave me $200, and I got picked up at the gate by this a girlfriend I had, and we went down the hill. I got out of Tehachapi. It was in December 23rd, 1985. And we went down the hill in the car, and, you know, I was going to go check in with a parole officer because I wanted to do that so I could go get loaded, right? You know, so I wanted to get that out of the way. And because I didn't, you know, I figured he was going to interfere with that in some way. So I told Sandy, this girl I was running with, I said, you know, let's go do this right now. So we hit the parole office at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I had all these plans, man. I had this $200, and I was just, you know, I mean, I was just chomping. I wanted to get loaded. I wanted to slam real bad. And he wasn't there. I'm sorry, he's not in. Can you come back at 1:30? I said, sure. You bet I can. And needless to say, I didn't. A few days later, I showed back up, and I was off and running again, and by February, I was in another recovery home. And see, I learned how to survive. You know, one of the things in my active addiction, I learned how to survive by playing the game. See, I survived by conning people, manipulating people, and using people. That's how I survived. Okay? And I knew the game. I call it the recovery home circuit. I've been in many of them, you know, several. And when it got hard, okay, that's what I would do, okay? I would go into these places, take the heat off, get a little healthy, and move on, you know. That's how I ended up in this county. I ended up in Porterville. There was a place called the Clean Center. It was open for just a few months, and it closed down. I went in there. This guy, the story behind that is this guy that brought me up here wasn't just a hell of a guy. He was after my old lady, okay? He wanted her, so we figured if he dumped me off in Porterville, he could have her, you know? Well, the poor son of a bitch got her, okay? And I'm eternally grateful for him, you know? His motives were wrong, but he didn't know how much he helped me, you know? Okay? And I remember my first meetings in Porterville, you know? Monday night meeting on Henderson. Still there, Greg? Still there. I remember puking in the bathroom at that meeting. You know, I was about 2 days into a 5-day kick on that. And I remember people helping me, you know, massaging me and being supportive of me there. You know, and it felt real good. Really felt good. I stayed there 59 days, stayed clean 59 days, and one day I got, the guy that was running the place gave me $60. To this day, I still don't know why he gave me $60. He did, and I got loaded. And it's not on him, it's on me. And I remember it was in July of that year of 86, I guess, and I didn't have anywhere to go again. I had met a friend of mine named Dave. A lot of you know him from Vice AA, and he was in there at the same time I was, and I called him up sniffling on the phone, and, you know, the day before I just OD'd, and these two guys had walked me through all that. I'd spent all the money and had no place to go, no money, no nothing, you know. So, I mean, I'm a survivor, you know, and I was going to use these people, man. You know, these people that were kind to me. And I called them up and I sniveled and I cried and I know where to go and what am I going to do and somebody's got to help me. You know what? And they did. They said, we'll come get you. And they put me up in their house. That's where I first met my current wife, Jerry. And all the bedrooms were full because Jerry lived there with her son. Dave and his family lived there, and Dave and Jerry's parents lived there. So they pulled out the couch and threw a little mattress behind it for me, and that was my bed. And I was happy. I was happy. One of the rules was you can't use and stay there. Well, of course, you know, that's not a problem for me, right? Of course, you know, I stayed there about 2 or 3 months, and I had to leave because I couldn't stay clean. So I proceeded to move around. A guy put me up in Farmersville. I used in Farmersville. Stayed there for about 30 days. Stole money from him. He was the secretary of a meeting, and I ripped off the treasury while he was at work. Went and got loaded, I don't know, 50, 60 bucks. So obviously I had to leave. There was a guy, and I haven't seen him in a while. He had about a year or so clean at that time. Helped me out. So I had nowhere to live, and he had loaned me a car. He had two cars. I thought that was amazing. Somebody would have two cars. He gave me a job at the Times Delta. Got me a job there part-time. I'd work graveyard shifts there for minimum wage, and I worked there. And my first check, I quit. Went and got loaded. And that's it. I slept in that car, and right about November, you know, when I got clean, it gets cold in November around here, and I was feeling real sad, real lonely, real empty, and I was getting real tired. My last run was about 10 days. That's about as long as I could last. So I went and basically what happened was there was four guys that 12-stepped me and talked me into going into a recovery home. And I went into Pine Recovery Home November 15th, 1986, and I stayed in detox for 5 days and kicked this little lightweight habit, and I thought, huh. And I came downstairs and they told me, you know what, man, you can stay. You know, we really don't do heroin addicts, but we think you got a shot. You can stay. And I said, and I walked downstairs, you know, and there was like people that cared again. You know, I kept feeling that feeling, getting that feeling that there was somebody was caring about me, man. And I hadn't had that feeling in a long, long time, you know, that I could remember. People were caring, man, and it felt good, you know. And I wanted to stay, you know, except I just wasn't going to stay as long. You know, I just wasn't going to stay that long. I ended up living in that home 14 months. You know, I needed every day of that. I went to a lot of meetings because I had to. I was playing the game, and I thought, you know what, when the weather warms up about March, February, I'm out of here. I'm getting loaded, man, and I'm out of here. You know, this is good, but, you know, it ain't for me. Not forever. And, you know, needless to say, it didn't work that way. I'm still clean. What happened was I got to see Rick for what Rick really is or was, you know, and there wasn't very much of it that I liked, you know. I went to a meeting one night, and I went there really just to, you know, play my role, you know, because I had to, and you had to do a certain amount of meetings in a week, and I was sitting there and, you know, acting bad and frowning at everybody and don't get close to me. And this guy was sharing about how empty he felt inside, how lonely he felt inside, you know, how he didn't respect himself, you know. And I related, you know, I could relate. That man's, he died clean and sober, but he's in my thoughts often. He's in my thoughts often. He helped me a lot. Just by sharing his experience in a meeting. That's as close as we ever got. Played a major role in my recovery. I went home to the recovery home, and I went into my room, and I started thinking, and I cried, and I took a look at myself, but probably for the first time in my life, a good, hard, honest look at myself, you know, and I was scared, you know, and I felt trapped. It was like, you know, I'm afraid to go back to active addiction, but I'm also afraid to recovery because I don't know what that's like either. You know, I was just afraid. I had no concept of a higher power, you know. When I did that night, I worked the first step. I honestly worked the first step for the first time in my life. I was about 5 months clean. I worked the first step. I got honest with myself. And that's really, you know, they talk about spiritual principles around here in the program. One of them is honesty. And it's not talking about hurting your fellows, stealing from your fellow members or other people so much. That's part of it. It's talking about being real in here. Not lying to yourself anymore. You know? I had bullshitted myself all my life. You know? I'd honestly worked the first step in recovery. I admitted to myself that I are one. You know? And that was the beginning. You know, that was the beginning. And, you know, they talk about other, you know, the other principles. I didn't know, you know, I had a hard time with a higher power. And I don't know if any of you guys do, but I had a real hard time with a higher power. Getting the concept, man. You know, and I faked it. I didn't know how to pray. When I would pray, I felt like a pony. I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't believe it. But I did it anyway because they told me, fake it till you make it. You know, they told me that. And I tried it. I got hope around here. And I used to come to the meetings, and I started to listen, and I started to absorb, and I got hope. You know, because I heard people that had come from where I had come from, and were now living a different life. A different life. Okay? They worked. They didn't have to steal to get what they wanted. They didn't have to lie or cheat to get what they wanted. You know, they worked. They seemed to be happy most of the time. You know, there was a lot of hope. Some had that glow, you know, that I always wanted. See, one of the things I used to do was always compare my insides to your outsides. You know. I wanted to feel like you looked. You know, I just didn't know how to do that. You know, I didn't realize that it was an inside job at that point. I didn't understand that nobody else could do that but me, and it had to come from here. You know, I didn't have a concept. You know, I kept praying and working the second step. You know, I don't know what. You know, to me, the second step means being restored to sanity, and that kind of sanity is losing the obsession to use. You know, in the beginning, that's what it was for me. You know, I haven't had an obsession to use in many, many years. You know, I had a few thoughts, lots of thoughts. You know, every time I go to a meeting, I have a thought. But I haven't had an obsession to use. You know, I haven't had an obsession to return to that lifestyle, you know. Because I understand today that I can't use just one. I'm real clear on that, you know. Can't. It's not going to work. I feel like I've built a good foundation in recovery. I went to a speaker meeting several years ago at St. Paul's, and there was a guy from down south that came up, and he talked about building a foundation in recovery. And he said his sponsor made him read the book called The Three Little Pigs. And he was new in recovery, and he said, "The Three Little Pigs, what's that got to do with recovery, man?" You know, and I'm like, "Whoa, you know, I want to hear this," you know, and he says, and he went on to tell the story of the three little pigs. The first, if the wolf is addiction, the first pig, what it was, a sticks or straw, right? I've never read the book. Built his house out of straw, and the big bad wolf huffed and puffed and blew the house down. And the second little pig built his house out of sticks, and the big bad wolf huffed and puffed and he blew his house down. The third little pig was smart. He built a good, solid, strong foundation out of brick and mortar. And we all know what happened to the wolf, right? Couldn't get in. You know, when he did, he got his ass burned, right? You know, and that made a lot of sense to me. And a lot of things I've learned have either come from other members of the book. Okay? And you know, that guy sharing that at that time helped me. I don't remember much else about that meeting, but that 1 3-minute little pitch about the three little pigs. And I still remember that today, you know. I feel like I've done it. I feel like I've built a strong foundation. First three steps. Being honest, you know, getting some hope. Grab on to some hope, man. Get some hope. Whether you be old or new, get some hope. You know. And faith, you know. And I'm not no spiritual guru or anything like that, but I feel like I've got some faith. Faith is trust, you know. And I never did trust well till I got here. And I learned how to trust. Not just you, I learned how to trust in a higher power. You know what? I've been clean and sober for over 9 years now. And I've been okay. No, you don't have to do that. But the point I want to make is that I've been okay all that time. That sounds like a long damn time to me. You know, just 9 years period. Whether I'm using it or not. You know, it was a long time. I never did anything for 9 years. You know, but trust, see? And it was explained to me, because I had a hard time with the trust thing, you know, because where I ran, you didn't trust a lot of people, right? You know what? Because, you know, they sell bunk, they'll take your money, and rah, rah, you know, they always want something, you know. Addicts in active addiction are takers. They're not givers, they're takers. You know, and I was a taker. So it was explained to me about with the trust deal I told my first sponsor, I said, you know, I have a hard time with trust. I don't trust anybody. I don't trust nothing. You know, I had that arrogant attitude, you know, I don't trust a goddamn thing. He pulled my covers and he told me, yeah, when you went to the dope man and got the bag and put it in a ring and put it in your arm, you had some faith it was going to work, didn't you? You know, I said, well, that's different, you know. He said, so you know how to trust. That's bullshit, Rick. You know how to trust. You know. So I had to apply that. You know, there's a difference between wanting to trust and actually putting that into action. You know, having faith or trust is an action step. Okay, that's what I was taught. You know, to put that into action. Okay, that means do it. I think I'll just develop my faith. Well, you know, how the hell do you do that? You just do it, you know, even when you don't want to. That's what I did, you know. It was like, I don't want to do this. It ain't going to work. I'm going to get burned. Just go do it. You'll be okay. That's what he told me. And I would go do it, and I would be okay. And I learned how to trust. That's how I learned how. Okay, and it's grown. And it's grown, and it's grown. You know? It's action. You know? I can come to these meetings and sit on my ass and just think, you know, oh, I'm going to practice these principles in all of my affairs. And I've done this stuff. You know? I'm not slamming nobody. I live in a glass house. And, you know what? Nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change. You know? If I don't get into action, you know, I did a 4-step. I wrote a list of defects, of resentments, and went through it with my sponsor. And I left some things out because nobody was going to know. And I stayed sick with those secrets for a while. And I shared what I was willing to share at that time. And felt pretty good about it and went on to 6 and 7. And that's where I had some difficulties. I hear a lot of times about the 4-step is, you know, we share about it, and I did mine, sharing about it as being this big monster step. And my God, the 4-step. It's easy. It is easy. You know what's hard about that? For me, was sitting my ass down at the table with pen and paper. Taking some time for myself. Taking time to help myself. That was the hardest thing for me. Okay, about that. Alright? At that point in time, I didn't really feel like I was worth saving. That was one of the reasons. You know, I didn't feel like I was worth saving. You know, it's real sad for a human being to feel like that about themselves. But I did it, and at least I did it to the best of my willingness at that time. And I shared it with my sponsor, and we went on to 6 and 7, and that's where the real willingness comes. That's where the real willingness came. And I didn't have a lot of it all the time. I mean, I'm, you know, sometimes I'm a good example of recovery, sometimes I'm not, okay? Just good and bad days. And, you know, I got my list of defects from my 4-step, so if you want to do like, if you want your list, hopefully you won't burn your 4-step. I still have mine. And, we worked on those, and I made a list of people that I had harmed, my 8-step, and I still have it in my wallet, and there are actually some things crossed off. I did some 9-step stuff, some making some amends. There's still some more to go. But I asked my sponsor, I said, you know, how do you change the defects? You know, I mean, I got these things about me that I don't like, you know, and I want it to stop. I want to stop doing them. And I said, well, first you pray, and then you get into action. He was one of these people who said, you got to get into action, action, action. Do it. Do the footwork, you know. Sitting on your ass ain't going to get it done, Rick. Get up and do it. Let's start making some amends. That's how you change. You start making the amends. You know, and I thought, how's that going to help? You know, how's that going to help? And what happened was when I started doing that, you know, I started to feel better, you know, about myself. Most of the people accepted them, you know. So I didn't have to carry the guilt, the shame around that all the harm I inflicted on them again, you know. So anyway, I am a long-winded bastard, huh? That's a shortcoming. If you don't know what a shortcoming is, it's a defect in action. And anyway, I started doing that, and I started feeling better, and some of the things started changing. See, I'm a believer in you can't think yourself in the right living. You got to live yourself in the right thinking. You know, I believe that, well, because I'm living proof of it. I didn't want to do any of these things. Okay? When I came into recovery and I read the 12 steps on the wall, you know, they got them on the walls and shit, and I said, I don't want to do any of that stuff. I don't want to admit I'm powerless and I can't manage my own life. I don't want to rely and have faith in the higher power. I was the higher power. And I damn sure didn't want to tell everything about me to somebody else, you know. I didn't want to tell people, I'm sorry, you got to be shitting me. You see, I didn't want to do none of that stuff. Unfortunately, that's the road to recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. And when I started doing that, things started to change. Okay, my thinking started to change. You know, I don't lie nearly as much. You know, I still lie. Okay, I still lie, still exaggerate. I still got this look good thing. Okay, but I don't lie nearly as much. I don't steal anymore. I was a thief, man. A big time thief, you know. I mean, I stole from piggy banks and purses and shit like that, but I did some other things too. You know, I was a thief, you know. A liar, a cheat, and a con man. You know, and I don't do that as much anymore. Spiritual principles. Practice them in all of our affairs, as the 12 step says, you know, is difficult for me at times. Some days, like I said, I feel like I'm a good example of recovery, and then there's other days I don't feel like I'm a very good example. A while back, I'm going to close up with some personal experiences in my, in the recent future. The present is in your future, okay? God damn, Rick. You know, I have an illness, okay? I have a virus, and it's affected my liver. I have hepatitis C. It's caused cirrhosis of the liver. I have what they call necrotic cells, which means they're dead in your liver, and they don't regenerate once they're dead. I have cirrhotic cells, which means that they are scarring, okay? And that's what hepatitis C does, okay? And it's because I use dirty needles, okay? And I just found out about this in September, you know. There are probably a lot of us that have it, okay? And I don't mean to scare anybody, but I think we need to talk about these things, okay? In my family, we kept secrets, and it was like the elephant was in the living room, you know? And I think that it's important that we share. And one of the reasons I want to share it tonight is because I don't want sympathy. Hopefully my experience, strength, and hope can help another addict. And, you know, since I've been talking about this, a little bit in meetings, there's been other people that come up to me and share their experiences with me. So it helps. But, you know, I was thinking, you know, a minute ago about how nuts I got, man, for a while. Because I got real angry. I got really mad, really angry inside, really scared. See, when I get scared, I get angry. That's how I react. I get real pissed off, and I start pushing people away with my anger. Because I don't want them to get close to me. It goes back to that whole thing, man, of if you get close, you know, if I get close, then you're eventually going to fuck me over or you're going to leave. Somebody's going to get hurt, okay? And I was doing shit like I'm not working right now. I'm taking this anti-cancer mission. It's called interferon. It's designed to, it's supposed to kill the virus. Okay, and it has some side effects like moodiness and depression and all these things that, you know, I really need more of that. And I mean, a while back, before I started to deal with some of this anger, or at least confront some of this anger within, I was doing things like, I live on Tulare Avenue in Visalia, and that's a real busy street. You know, and people were like, drive by and look at me stupid, and I'd flip them off. And, you know, I'd sit in my chair and smoke cigarettes, and little girls would walk by, and they, one day, one of them threw a pomegranate in my front yard, and I yelled at them, cussed them out, and threw it back, and, I mean, I really did this, you know, and I'm not proud of it, but I want to share. That's kind of the state of mind I was in, you know. It was right before my birthday, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, and then you're going to go down and celebrate your birthday, you know, and tell them how spiritual you are. You know, and you're throwing shit at kids, you know, and, but that's where I was at, you know, and I was really angry, really scared, and I was in a grieving process, and still am. One of the things that I was angry about was losing my health, and then to change the lifestyle, not working. And I don't know how you feel, but I don't feel complete, you know, like a whole person if I'm not doing something, you know, if I'm not working, you know. That kind of goes back to the way I used to live, you know, and it brings up old stuff for me. And I was having a hard time dealing with it. My wife was having a hard time dealing with it. She was living with an asshole. Okay? Really was. I didn't know how to stop it, man. I mean, it's kind of like knowing you got these character defects but not knowing how to change it, not knowing what to do about it. And I didn't know how to stop it, man, because I didn't like, I mean, that's not me. I don't throw shit at kids. You know? I don't cuss people out. You know, I don't do that, man. But I was doing it. And I didn't like it. It scared me. You know. And I didn't know what to do about it. You know, so I started talking about it more with people. And you know what I did, you know, was this worked for me. And I've had a good few weeks. The last 3-4 weeks have been really good. I felt pretty good. Because I felt real disconnected, you know. I rely on my higher power today. Where I used to fake it to survive in recovery, I gotta have it. I have to. You know? I'm real clear on that. I have to have it. And I was losing that, man. And I could see that and I could feel that. I didn't feel it anymore. And I was scared. I was scared. And I didn't know what to do to get that back. You know, I felt like in the early days when I would pray and it didn't feel right, you know, and I felt like, and this little voice would go off going, yeah, you don't mean it, you know, there ain't no such thing. You know, I had that old thinking back, man, and I was scared, and, you know, but I worked through some of the grieving process and I've come to terms with, you know, sometimes life ain't always fair, you know, and just because you're in recovery doesn't mean that everything's going to be wonderful, you know. Life still goes on, and sometimes it's shitty, you know. There's nothing I can do about it, you know, except learn how to take care of myself. You know, I drink goddamn water. I love coffee and soda. I don't drink it anymore, you know, because it's bad for the liver. I don't eat red meat anymore. It's not good, you know. Low fat. I eat low fat. She like chicken. God damn, how many goddamn ways can you cook chicken, you know? A lot more than you think. you know, and other things, you know. I drink juice. I take vitamins, you know, and things like that. So I made some major lifestyle changes, you know. And I didn't want to do them, man. It was like when I first came into recovery, I fought like hell. You know, to do that. You know, people would say, Rick, if you just quit using drugs, your life would be better. And I went, oh, shit, right, you know. Now they're telling me, if you would just change your diet and do this and do that, your life will be better. And I went, yeah, right. You know, so now I started doing some of that. You know what? It's getting better. You know, and I feel better inside. You know, I feel better. You know, I've had a good few weeks, you know. I just wanted to share that, and maybe it'll help somebody. You know, I don't know why they asked me here tonight. I told Jennifer, boy, they're really getting desperate. But I heard a guy say on a tape that a long time ago, he said, you know, I don't know why they asked me here. He says, but, you know, there's a reason. He says, my higher power sent me here for a reason. He said, there's one person out here that needs to hear what I have to say. So the rest of you just sit down and be quiet. So he can hear. Anyway, I'm very grateful to be here tonight. I have a wonderful life, and it's because I'm involved in recovery. Even though there are some ups and downs, you know, I have a wonderful life. And thank you for listening.